Welcome to this week's podcast from Innovation Forum with me, Ian Welsh. As usual, we have a mix of news and comment and the best of our regular interviews with business experts. Coming up shortly is a fascinating interview my colleague Toby Webb did recently with Gabriel Toomey, Head of Capital Markets at Climate Advisors, who outlines the financial risks that big companies in the extractive sector, in agriculture, commodities and others, are running by not dealing with environmental and social risks and supply chains properly. In addition, I caught up with Nicole Rycroft from Canopy about the linkages between forest ecosystems, textile manufacturing and apparel supply chains. Before that, though, our weekly roundup of some of what's happening in business and sustainability. The certification debate came back into focus again this week with the publication of a new report by NGO, the Changing Markets Foundation. The False Promise of Certification report follows up research by the foundation investigating whether voluntary certification schemes for seafood, textiles and palm oil are accurately guiding consumers towards sustainable products. The report's conclusions are that there is a lack of evidence for benefit of certification schemes and, worse, they provide greenwashing cover for companies that are, Changing Markets Foundation says, destroying the environment. The report calls for the abolition of some certification schemes and the deep-rooted reform of others. On seafood, the report states that nearly 90% of global fish stocks are either fully fished or overfished. It alleges that both the Marine Stewardship Council and Friends of the Sea, who certify over 9 million tonnes of fish each, have certified as sustainable fisheries that are overfished or of high bycatch levels. Hitting back, MSC accused Changing Markets Foundation of cherry-picking, saying that nearly all MSC-certified fisheries are required to make improvements and that, in fact, in many regions, fish stocks show higher biomass following MSC certification. Friends of the Sea made a similar rebuttal. The textile sector comes in for criticism too, accused of a general lack of transparency and a poor record on water pollution in particular, despite the many certification initiatives around. Picked out is the Better Cotton Initiative, which, among other things the report alleges, has driven farmers to switch from organic to GM cotton. BCI described the report as factually inaccurate, misleading, and not a constructive dialogue that can result in progress. On palm oil, the report says that no major palm oil certification scheme has been able to slow deforestation rates or loss of biodiversity. It picks out the Roundtable for Sustainable Palm Oil for allowing conversion of secondary forest and peatland draining. In response, the RSPO has said that it is working on many of the issues raised in the report while defending its work protecting millions of hectares of primary forest. Elsewhere in palm oil this week, while meeting with Indonesian President Widodo, Chinese Prime Minister Li made clear an intention to increase China's importation of palm oil from Indonesia by 500,000 tonnes, a sizeable increase on the 2.6 million tonnes exported to China in 2017. Palm oil watchers point out that China's less regulated markets contrast with, for example, the EU, which has criticised the Indonesian Sustainable Palm Oil Foundation and the RSPO for failing to prevent deforestation and peat fires. The EU has been increasing the pressure on the palm oil sector, banning its use in certain circumstances because of the commodity's link with deforestation. As it stands, China does not impose such restrictions, so the potential environmental implications of a greater proportion of the Indonesian crop heading there are clear. Now, while supply chains such as palm oil can seem a bit remote from consumers, household food waste is, on the face of it, something that we should all be concerned about. That was the basis of a scheme in the UK backed by retailer Sainsbury's, which had signed up to back a £10 million Waste Less, Save More programme with the aim of cutting consumer food waste by 50%. It was launched in 2015 with a pilot scheme in the market town of Swadlincote. However, the plug has been pulled on the project as householders' waste only dropped by around 9%, reports suggest, with consumers telling Sainsbury's that the issue simply wasn't a priority for them. The supermarket has absorbed the programme into its wider well-being work, but what's clear is that the thorny challenge of how to engage consumers in sustainability is alive and well. Finally, in the 3 years since the UK's Modern Slavery Act, while the issue's profile has certainly been raised, a new study from the Gangmasters and Labour Abuse Authority makes sobering reading. It says that the number of British victims of labour exploitation increased 362% from 2016 to 2017. Debt bondage is a tactic that is increasing, as well as the use of social media to entice workers to the UK for work that doesn't exist. The GLAA's findings come on the heels of a number of other revelations of serious labour violations in the UK, particularly in the textiles and apparel sector. So there's a lot of work still to do. This week is the last chance to pick up discounted passes for Innovation Forum's next event on how business can tackle forced labour and modern slavery in New York on June 12th and 13th, featuring experts from Walmart, Barrick Gold, Intel, GE and many more. Sign up by the end of the week to save $150. And there are still discounted passes available for our management conference on measuring the return on investment of corporate sustainability in London on 19th and 20th of June with Cargill, Novo Nordisk, Mars, CDP and many more. Hope to see you there. We've got two interviews for you this week. Coming up, I speak with Canopy's Nicole Rycroft about how demand for viscose in the apparel sector has led to increased deforestation risks. But firstly, at the Nature Conservancy in Washington, D.C. recently, Toby Webb met with Gabriel Toomey from Climate Advisors to put some hard numbers on supply chain risks.
You wear a number of different hats, but as a former banker, I think it's fair to say you're a bit of a sustainable finance expert. And you currently work for capital markets, but you also are involved in producing a chain reaction research. And you put these briefing notes out, which I think are brilliant because they put numbers on sustainability risk, which I think is very, really helpful. And I know for a fact lots of big companies read it. So congratulations for doing that work. I think it's really powerful. And you've just done a session here at our conference at the Nature Conservancy in Washington, D.C., about risk and the potential risks companies are facing around sustainability and supply chains if they don't tackle them. So I think that's a fascinating area to explore. So, Gabriel, why don't you just talk us through what you've been saying in the previous session, and then we'll see where the conversation leads us.
That sounds great. And thank you, Toby. So at Climate Advisors, we have a team of about 10 analysts, and we look at risks associated with deforestation. One of the projects we work on is called Chain Reaction Research, and that's a coalition of three organizations. We're very fortunate to work with wonderful colleagues at Profundo, who do financial analysis, and Aid Environment, who do sustainability risk analysis, both in the Netherlands. So all three organizations create chain reaction research. Chain reaction research puts an economic price on deforestation. I can tell you how much it costs your company if you or your friends and family are deforesting a property illegally or engaged in human rights abuses. Human rights abuses include not paying your staff legal wages. These supply chain risks upstream, we have seen over the last 3 years, have gone from being a correlation event to a causation event to now a materiality event. And we've seen share prices of companies, of Fortune 500 companies, go up and go down as a result of how they manage these supply chain risks.
So let's talk about a couple of specific examples that you guys have done research on. I'm not going to name any specific ones myself, but I've seen these briefing notes you've done in the slides you had earlier, you mentioned some companies. So give us a couple of examples of companies that our listeners might recognize or sectors in which these companies operate that they might recognize where sustainability has had real material financial impact.
As a true Wall Street analyst, I will start with the sector because everything's sector-based. We see impacts in the mining sector, in the oil and gas trading and exploration sector. We see impacts in the timber sector, cattle and agriculture soft commodity sector. These are all upstream. In the midstream, we see impacts in the trading sector, such as Cargill, Bunge, and others, in the transport sector, and then downstream in the retail sector. We see impacts throughout the spectrum of risks, starting with operational risk and migrating to reputation, legal regulatory, market, credit, liquidity, business, and strategic risks. What happens is that if someone cuts a tree illegally, or they don't pay their staff a correct wage, or they steal someone's land, that's a direct operational risk. That then you can put a financial price on in the other seven risk categories I previously mentioned. Most importantly, we see the price of risk occurring in market risk, credit risk, and broadly around business risk.
So which are the companies you would cite in the deforestation space that have suffered? And can you tell us a little bit about them, a couple of recent examples?
In the end of March of 2016, IOI Corporation, which is one of the top four or five palm oil producers in the world, was suspended from the Roundtable on Sustainable Palm Oil, which is an ecosystem certification mechanism. They were suspended because in 2009 and 2010, they illegally deforested about 11,000 hectares, or 25,000 acres. This is a protected area in Southeast Asia. They did not resolve that situation, and they did not restore that property. As a result, 27 large corporate buyers from Cargill, Bunge, Unilever, Nestle, and many others, Kellogg's, for example, suspended or stopped procuring palm oil as a feedstock from IOI. because IOI was caught deforesting a property illegally. If I then buy that commodity from IOI, I now am in the chain of custody of an illegal good. More from their point of view, that's how we look at it. In hindsight, in real time, from the point of view of the corporations, IOI deforesting the property violated their procurement policies around zero deforestation. As a result, IOI's share price decreased about 20% in 6 weeks. They lost $800 million. Moody's, one of the three large credit rating agencies in the world, put IOI on notice for negative review and possible negative downgrade. Their second quarter earnings in 2016, earnings of shareholders, was negative $15 million. As a result, IOI has now changed its organizational structure around palm oil, and it's changed its philosophy at the executive level around risk management, and has changed how it's managing risk and its risk culture, starting from the staff to the manager to the executive and back to the manager and to the staff. So since then, the company has rebounded. But that's an example of a company losing $800 million because of deforestation risk.
Do you think that incident had anything to do with the sale of much of the business to another company? Well, that was going to happen anyway. I wonder if there's a discount in play because of what happened.
It's a good question. So IOI sold its downstream specialty fats division for $946 million to Bunge. And that was 8 months ago, I believe. The issue is that specialty fats division is a high margin division. The name of that division is Loders Croklaan. So why would IOI sell its high margin division to finance its low margin palm oil production division? I don't know. From a conjecture perspective, I think they may have sold it as a cash infusion for their Malaysian palm oil operations and to return to their core business model of growing oil palm trees.
There are other examples you cite in the slide you showed and in the notes you've done. JBS in Brazil, I think, is another example, and that's a different side of deforestation. That's on the cattle side. Just to briefly talk our listeners through that case and the consequences.
JBS is a fascinating story. The company is maybe 30 or 40 years old, but about 15 years ago, when Brazil as a nation felt a sense of threat of other corporations coming into Brazil and purchasing their assets. So as a result, the Brazilian National Development Bank, BNDES, would provide loans and concessional finance to Brazilian corporations to fend off possible outside hostile bids. As a result, JBS took money in 2006 and bought Swift Company, a very large publicly traded meat packer in the United States. When they made that purchase, they essentially misstated the price to BNDES for how much it would cost per equity share. This resulted in a $70 million discount to JBS. In other words, the executives pocketed $70 million at the expense of the Brazilian public, which owns BNDES. That was uncovered and announced last year. At the same time last year, it was announced that JBS had purchased 59,000 head of cattle from an area of about 200,000 hectares of illegally deforested cattle ranches. JBS argued that the cattle was certified as deforestation free by the Brazilian government. Yet, if I'm certified as a bank robber by Toby and I go rob a bank, I'm still robbing a bank. So as a result, Domino's and Waitrose suspended purchasing from JBS. Likewise, they also suspended purchasing from JBS last June because JBS was caught sourcing cattle from ranches in Brazil that were known for slavery and for enforced labor. The same time last year, this is all in the same 2 to 3 month period, JBS was caught doing two other things. One, the executives at JBS, the owners, the Batista brothers, were involved in bribing 1,900 Brazilian politicians. Then they were also caught bribing, I don't know the exact number, but many people in the food safety industry in Brazil. As a result, China stopped importing beef from JBS. In fact, at one point at the end of March last year in 2017, there were container ships with beef from JBS stuck outside the ports of Shanghai who were not allowed to enter. There are other examples of issues that occurred. The reason why I mention these four or five issues is that what we find around deforestation risk and human rights abuses is that these are not single events generally. They are a flag, a signal to Wall Street that risk may be there in other areas. Knowing about the deforestation risk, we saw the human rights risk with JBS. Knowing about the human rights risk of JBS, we saw them lying about their Swift purchase in 2006, etc. As a result, Wall Street suspended the IPO of JBS in 2017. So we see many examples where a single risk that may start to get known to the market, although it may or may not be material, often is a signal of material risks elsewhere. Noble Group is a very good example of that. Noble Group in 2013 was one of the 100 largest companies on earth. And I'm not sure what its exact market cap is today, but last I looked, it was about $100 million. In other words, its market capitalization had decreased at least 99% in the last 4 years. This was driven by many issues. Again, many multiple governance level risks that we can observe from an environmental lens or a social or labor lens. But Noble Group, we and with our partners, Environmental Investigation Agency, were able to uncover and demonstrate to their auditors, Ernst & Young, that in fact, Noble Group had misstated, or not using accounting jargon, lied about its financial accounting from 2013 to 2016. For 4 years, it stated that its 200,000-acre palm oil concessions in Papua, part of Indonesia, were available for sale, and they were able to inflate the price of these palm oil assets on their balance sheet. We demonstrated this to their auditor and their chief financial officer in the end of July of 2017, and as a result, they discounted or decreased the valuation of their palm oil assets in the subsequent earnings announcement in early August of 2017 by $60 million. Many other pieces of data would have gone into that decision by those executives, and I cannot pretend to understand what that other data was. I just know my part of the story. If you think of the whole story of Noble Group or JBS or IOI as an alphabet, I sometimes know I'm a letter B out of the alphabet, only one of 26 letters, or a letter Z, one of 26 letters. But we are able now to see in the last 3 years demonstrably that deforestation risk and at times human rights abuses and labor risks have a material impact on corporations as their share prices decrease 20, 30, 40%, and in some cases, some companies have gone into bankruptcy. This is on the downside. On the upside, we see companies who manage these risks well and effectively, who apply basic risk management principles that any project manager would use in any non-environmental related field. Those companies have seen their share prices increase. An example is MP Evans. It trades on the London Stock Exchange as MPE. They were a subject of a hostile takeover by Kuala Lumpur Kempang, a very large palm oil company, in the fall of 2016. They told their shareholders, we're going to do an independent audit of our palm oil assets to see what the true value is. It came up with a range of $13,000, $14,000, $15,000 per hectare. They then said, we're going to hold off on selling the shares. That's what they recommended to their shareholders, to hold off on selling because we believe that we can get a better price. As a result, their share price went up 58%. In about 3.5 months, and they sold their palm oil assets for $100 million. These 8,700 hectares that they sold were Roundtable Sustainable Palm Oil certified. That's an upside example of how companies can manage their risks and make an enormous amount of money. If someone told me I can make 58% in a stock position in 3 months, as a former trader, you know what? I'm all in.
So some good examples there. Thank you, Gabriel. And during the conference earlier, you were talking about how both financial and legal risks to companies engaged in deforestation and human rights abuses are growing. So those are great examples. And I think we both wish the markets in general had taken more notice of them earlier, but in the end they did. How, in your view, are these risks now multiplying and growing?
The risks are multiplying and growing if we use the metric of time, the distance from when the risk occurs to when it then shows up in the financial statement and the market notices it. That time frame is collapsing, is decreasing, it is shortening rapidly. Previously, a company might be involved in a risky venture and it might take 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 years for that risk to be priced into its equity, into its share price. Now we're seeing risks being priced in within 3 months, even 2 months.
Why is that happening?
It's because these risks are being understood as material by credit analysts and by sell-side analysts. 3 years ago, Ed Morse, who's a very well-respected sell-side analyst in the oil and gas sector, who works at Citibank and runs their commodities division, he published a paper, along with many of his colleagues, called New Darwinism 2. When Ed Morse from Citi is talking about environmental risks as material, we know that the insiders are paying attention. So what happens is that instead, and previously, environmental and social risks were seen as an outsider issue being pushed by NGOs using an ethical and moral lens. Now these risks are seen as emblematic or a signal to markets of other governance risks that can be financially material, or the environmental and social risks themselves can also be financially material. And as such, it's an insider game. So when we do our analysis, we're often contacted by hedge funds and traders for stock pick advice. I obviously cannot tell them what's happening. We know that our analysis at Chain Reaction Research is material to equity prices, so we don't provide any notice, but on the companies we're analyzing. So that's what's happening.
So just to build on that then, what about legal criminal risk? You mentioned the FCPA, the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, first passed in 1977, enforced by the Department of Justice more and more since then, has often been used against kind of infrastructure, construction, oil and gas, and mining companies, prohibits the payment of bribes to officials abroad, but it does have facilitation payments.
Mm-hmm.
Caveat. And it's a subject we've covered in other areas for many years. It's interesting that you mention that now with relation to deforestation risks in this sector. So perhaps tell us a bit more about why you mentioned that and why you think there might be more criminal risks on the horizon.
So if we think of environmental and social risks over time, as young people, we would have grown up with environmental and social risks for us learning about that, maybe in college or through another media source, and learning that there's an ethical and moral lens to the food and commodities we consume. Over the last 3 years, we've been able to demonstrate conclusively, I would suggest, that deforestation and human rights risks are now material. So now we know there's financial materiality. It's a second step. The first step was ethical and moral. Now we can look back and say there's financial materiality. The next 3-4 years, we're going to see many cases that are addressing legal risks. And that's because here in Washington, D.C., we are aware of U.S. government agencies who are starting to consider human rights and deforestation risks to be defined within as a criminal activity. And therefore, they will apply a set of U.S. regulations and laws, such as the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, anti-money laundering laws, wire and mail fraud, obstruction of justice, and unfair and deceptive trade practices acts. They're considering applying these to corporations that lie about deforestation risk. Whether, you know, if they sell a product they say is legally sourced, but it's illegally sourced, or if they're lying about human rights abuses. So on the horizon, in the near term, publicly traded companies and privately traded companies around the world need to know that they are on notice. There are people in the U.S. government who are considering applying these laws to their illicit and illegal activities.
There are those listening who might say, well, under Obama, we could see that happening. If Hillary Clinton had won the election, even though she won the popular vote by 2.5 million, let's not get bogged down in that. If Hillary had won, we could see that happening. But in the current political climate, is it credible to suggest this? I mean, there will be sceptical listeners out there who are saying to themselves, where's Gabriel getting this from? There's not much appetite to do anything except deregulate at the moment.
And I have a big smile on my face because I appreciate those sceptics. And I invite those sceptics. We need to have a rich conversation around these issues. I'm only a messenger on this, having attended and worked with, as an observer, the law enforcement community over the last year. And I'm reporting what they have told me. I'm not much of a political analyst, so I don't have much to say on that. I can only reflect on the fact that under the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, for example, in the second component of the act, or the second branch, if you would, it states that you need to report your books and records accurately. If those books and records are inaccurately reported, and then that involves a U.S. dollar transaction, that can be considered a criminal activity.
Okay. That's criminal cases. Do you think there might be a rise in civil cases claiming that because companies have lied to shareholders about risks, for example, they can be sued by shareholders for lying about those risks because they've hurt shareholder value? Is that a possibility?
Yes, Toby. So if we think of in the legal space, we have civil and criminal. The criminal is further on the horizon. The civil has already started to occur. I'm an analyst, so I want to reference data points. That's how my world works. So by the end of March of 2017, there was a class action lawsuit by shareholders of JBS's equity against JBS's executives for lying about any number of governance risk issues I just described. You know, there's shareholder fraud, there's lying about financial statements, deforestation risk issues, human rights issues, the package. So that class action lawsuit has already started. So in that sense, yes, the civil risks are here, front and center, not well known, but are occurring. And the criminal risks, those liabilities will start to occur, I would suggest, in the next 2 to 3 years.
Great. Well, Gabriel, thank you so much for your time. We'll keep a watching brief on these developments.
Yeah.
And this is something Innovation Forum are going to be covering more and more in our conferences and audio streams and editorial. For those of you interested in Gabriel's work, I commend it to you. I believe the URL is chainreactionresearch.com. where you can sign up for updates and see his analysis as it comes out. And just remains for me to say thank you so much for listening. And Gabriel, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much. And I'm very fortunate to be part of a wonderful team, including Aid Environment and Profundo, who help write chain reaction research. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So thanks to Toby and Gabriel. Now, when I was in Amsterdam for our Sustainable Apparel Conference, I caught up with Nicole Rycroft from Canopy. We're here at an apparel sector conference, but your primary interest is in deforestation. Why are you here?
Well, I know it's not necessarily intuitive, but there is a direct link between the fashion industry and forest ecosystems around the world. Trees, those things that can give us a splinter, actually are the base material, the raw material for those soft, silky, delicious fabrics that we have come to know and love, which go under a myriad of names, be it viscose, rayon, modal, and other man-made cellulosics is the technical term.
What is it about the material that means it contains such significant deforestation risks? What is it that's in it that's becoming such a risk for deforestation?
Yeah, so there are 150 million trees that disappear into viscose and rayon fabrics every year. It's slated to double over the course of the next decade, and much of that is being sourced from ancient and endangered forests around the world. So from really high carbon value, high conservation value forests, as well as from forest regions where there's significant social conflict. And so my organization, Canopy, we're an environmental not-for-profit. We work to protect forest ecosystems around the world and to help stabilize our climate and advance community rights. And so we, over the course of the last 5 years, have been working with the fashion industry, with brands in particular, to build a fence at the top of the cliff rather than a hospital at the bottom with regards to the viscose supply chain.
Well, why has the fashion industry been sourcing for viscose from such sensitive woodland? Are there not other more easily replenished woodlands that they could use?
To be honest, up until 5 years ago, folks had no idea that the viscose fabrics and rayons that they were using were actually coming from ancient and endangered forest ecosystems. And it is one of those things. Viscose is one of multiple products that the global forest products industry produces alongside of paper and packaging and tissue products. All of those products, some of it comes from sustainably managed forest ecosystems. Ideally, they're FSC certified. But there's still a really significant portion of all of those products that are derived from these high carbon, high biodiversity value forests.
Okay, well, we can go back to some of the solutions to that in a minute, perhaps. Can you explain a little bit about the viscose supply chain? What does it look like? Who's involved in it? Where are they sourcing from? Who's milling to create, you know, the finished product?
Sure. It's actually a fairly complex supply chain, which is why I think up until we raised the issue with brands 5 years ago, many of them were actually unaware of their potential link to these really critical frontline forest ecosystems around the world. So essentially what happens is a forest is logged. Those trees are then sent to what's called a dissolving pulp mill. It's then basically stuck in a giant blender with a very intense mix of toxic chemicals for the most part. What comes out the other end of that process is dissolving pulp. That is basically the pure cellulose that was in the tree. And generally you end up with 22 to 40% of the tree that was fed into the pulp mill coming out the other end as dissolving pulp. So it's a very inefficient pulping process in terms of what ends up actually being yield for manufacturing textiles. That pulp's then sent to a viscose mill where it's mixed up with another bunch of chemicals, shot through a giant shower head, and you end up with this very fine filament that is the viscose stable fiber. That's then sent to a spinner, a weaver, a dyer into the garment manufacturing process. And then it ultimately ends up in both the high-end boutiques as well as the malls and the fast fashion retailers that we all love to shop at.
So how much viscose is there in clothing then? What's the sort of percentage in rough terms and, you know, the amount of clothing that we have on the high street? I mean, how much or what proportion of it contains viscose?
Yeah, it really varies from brand to brand, and it is in luxury fashion and it is in t-shirts that you will buy for, you know, like $2. So it does really span a gamut of labels as well as products. Some brands use 7% of their overall fiber mix is viscose, and some of them it's like up in between 30 and 40%.
And in terms of the total amount then, per year. You mentioned the number of trees that are destroyed every year for viscose. It was, you gave us the number earlier on.
150 million trees.
150 million trees. And what does that represent in terms of the total world deforestation in the course of a year then? What's the percentage of that?
So viscose is still relatively small compared to paper and packaging and tissue in particular. We're looking at between 6 to 8%, so it's still in single digits. But the thing that really caught our attention about viscose was the fact that it was slated to double and on such an aggressive timeline. Mm-hmm. And so by virtue of the projected ramp up in production capacity, that it was actually going to emerge as a really aggressive threat to forest ecosystems, both in terms of driving deforestation, as well as just forest degradation and sure. impacting these critical sure. landscapes.
And just to get an idea then of the impact of the industry, I mean, you mentioned obviously there's the deforestation side of things, then there's the chemical side of things. Mm-hmm. Is the impact in the deforestation, or is it also in the use of the toxic chemicals in its production? Where's the balance?
So there are three primary buckets where viscose has a footprint. The first one is obviously where we focus, and it's the impact that viscose production has on high carbon, high biodiversity value forests and frontline communities, so ancient and endangered forests. The second bucket is around the use, the kind of the chemical and the toxics profile of its production and just how intensive that is. And then the third bucket is around this overall fiber efficiency piece and just the fact that it is a low percentage of the tree that ultimately ends up in the fabrics that we buy. Our focus is on addressing the impacts and basically shifting the supply chain at this inflection point. 150 million trees is a big impact on forest ecosystems around the world, but it's slated to double within the next decade. And so we're at that inflection point where we can redirect it to be more sustainable, build a fence at the top of the cliff rather than a hospital at the bottom and doing triage like we normally do once there are billions of dollars worth of mill infrastructure put in exactly the wrong places like the Amazon or the boreal or Indonesia's rainforest.
Sure. So is the solution you're looking for, is it to reduce the amount of viscose that is used in the fashion sector? Or is it to make that more sustainable? Or is it, in fact, to kind of eliminate it entirely and use something else in the sector? Or is it a mixture of all of that?
So we currently work with 150 brands in our Canopy Style initiative, and they are all committed to not sourcing from ancient and endangered forests. They are all committed to helping support commercial scale production of next generation solutions. So fabrics that are made from recycled fabrics, fabrics that are made from straw or byproducts of other processes, fabrics that ultimately have a much lighter environmental and production footprint. And then the 150 brands that we work with, and they range from, you know, the big guys like H&M and Zara and The Gap and Levi's to pace setters like Stella McCartney and Eileen Fisher and Marks and Spencer's, they're all committed to also helping secure protection of these landscapes of hope around the world. So I think from our perspective, as we move into Canopy Style 2.0, this next five-year stage of our work with the industry, the bottom line for us will be clearing the supply chain of ancient and endangered forest fiber, and it will be really prioritizing the commercial scale production of these next generation solutions and just how critical they are, closing that loop of production, how critical that is going to be to not only addressing the impact on forest ecosystems, but also the chemical footprints, the water use, and ultimately how do we have a more sustainable sure. fashion sector?
Who is driving the change in this sector? There's the non-profit sector like yourselves mm-hmm. who are driving the change. But is there an industry drive to reducing the amount of viscose in clothing and looking for solutions, other solutions as well?
Yeah, I mean, as I mentioned, we have 150 brand partners that are involved in this. And as charming and smart as I would like to think that we are at Canopy, it's really because of our brand partners that we've been able to galvanize the level of action that we have. So by engaging alongside, working together with brands, we have been able to secure similar commitments from viscose producers that represent 70% of global production. And at this point, viscose producers that represent 25% of global production are actually verified as being at low risk of sourcing from an ancient and endangered forest area. And we have viscose producers that represent probably about another 30% of the global supply chain of viscose completing the Canopy Style audits at the moment. And so I think, you know, brands are driving this, working with each other and working with Canopy. Together, we're working with the viscose supply chain, and there's definitely leadership being shown within the viscose supply chain as well. I think the motivations for brands really varies. For some of them, they're really looking for solutions, right? Like they're wanting to eliminate risk from their supply chain. They're wanting to show leadership on issues where there's a potential to really shift a supply chain proactively in a direction rather than having to deal with something that's deeply entrenched and problematic. And I think one of the values that we bring with working together is that there's a real complement of skills. The expertise and supply chain transformation experience that Canopy has dealing with the forest product supply chain complements the work that brands have and the broader sustainability expertise that they have and obviously the deep knowledge that they have of their supply chains.
And is ultimately then, will we ultimately see no viscose at all, or is it going to be a much, do you think, a kind of far less viscose used in clothing is probably the best solution?
I think that given the pressures that there are on cotton, on arable land, I think that we're going to continue to see viscose. I'm really confident that we won't see it being sourced from ancient and endangered forest ecosystems by 2020. And I think sort of by the time we make it into the early 2020 on, we'll be seeing an increasing amount of fiber in our fashion that is derived from these next generation solutions. And so whether that's a pure cellulosic product, which is equivalent to viscose, or whether these new technologies take us in a slightly different direction, I can't say at this point.
Certainly lots of space for innovation around different fibres to be used in apparel. Nicole from Canopy, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks Ian.
Some dates for your diary. On October 2nd and 3rd, we will be in Detroit, where we'll be partnering with the Herb Institute to debate corporate sustainability impacts. 16th and 17th of October, we will be in Amsterdam for our next event on sustainable plastics. And 6th to 7th November, we'll be holding our new Sustainable Landscapes Conference in London. We'll be releasing full details over the coming weeks. And don't forget to sign up this week for our June Modern Sustainability event in New York. That's it for now. I've been Ian Welsh, and we'll be back next week.